Now, when you walk into the ring for the number one heavyweight of the world, you'll be ready, won't you? Why? Because I waited for 50 years to make you ready. You'll be able to spit nails, kid. Like the guy says, you're gonna eat lightning and you're gonna crap thunder. You're gonna become a very dangerous fighter.
Our show's name pays tribute to the Boer Trekkers of South Africa, who in 1838 soundly defeated 30,000 Zulus on the bank of the Nkomo River, thereafter called Blood River, from the water turning red with the blood of the slain. Miraculously, no Boer Trekker died and only three were wounded. Now your friend, Eddie Miller, will be your ambassador for tonight's show.
Well, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, all you people out there listening to Blood River Radio, all of our dear Blood River Radio family who've made this show possible by spreading the word and sending in your contributions, your donations, keeping us, as Gene Andrews says, who's going to be on with us tonight, thank God, to your war contributions. Anyway, folks, it is looks like it is July the 24th in the year of our Lord and Savior, 2021, and we always say that there's no name under the sun which man can be saved other than Jesus Christ, and that is true. We also know people that drill before we do anything else. We'll say a quick prayer, so if you will. I won't read the scripture this up. I couldn't make up my mind exactly which one, so we'll just do the scripture next week. We'll just say a little prayer tonight. Almighty Father, our God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of Eddie Miller, the God of Blood River Radio, the God of Gene Andrews, the God of Liberty News Radio, and Sam, and all of our friends and loved ones. Thank you so much for bringing us here yet another day. Thank you for giving us the courage, and thank you for giving us the opportunity to fight again for you in what little way we can against the beast, against that beast that's hounding us, white Christian people all over the world. Thank you so much, God. And Lord, if it ever hits the fan really full time, heavy, please keep me alive where I can participate in it physically. I want to do that as my last act on this earth, if at all possible. Anyway, Lord, if you will, continue to bless our show. Bless all of our loved ones we just mentioned. My family, Gene's family. Bethany's on the air. She's taking the board with us tonight. Bless her. She just got out of high school. She's a little bit sick, Lord. She's been sick the last couple of days. If you will, perk that little child up so she can go on her singing tour she's going on pretty soon. Anyway, Lord, and never let us forget where all these blessings come from. Never let us take anything for granted. And God, please don't ever let me or any of our people become proud, become arrogant, get an ego, because, Lord, we know you can bring us down. Anyway, ask all this in your Son's name, Jesus Christ Almighty, who, like we said earlier, Lord, who died on the cross for us while we were yet sinners. Ask all this in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, people, we're going right next to, we got some mail. And we got donors. Thank God that I'm going to read this card. It says, "Hey, Blood River Gang, I sent out this letter Wednesday, hoping it would arrive by Saturday, and it did. I hope you guys would cover the South Africa chaos." This is funny. "It reminds me of Planet of the Apes by Charles Heston. No pun intended." It says, "Thanks, Micah." In Maryland, Micah, it most certainly is Planet of the Killer Apes. There was a book written, I forgot who wrote it. Gene, maybe Gene will know, but it's called The Killer Apes. But you're all so right. We got another letter, and this letter here was directed right at Gene Andrews. It says, "Dear Eddie and Blood River Radio, because I had nothing to do with this project here. Gene was 100% did it with his, he's a genius, he really is. He has a memory like unlike any other, and he's sincere. But anyway, says, like I said, it said, "Dear Eddie and Blood River Radio, I wanted to comment you and thank you for your recent progress program on the so-called Civil War in the U.S. United States history." See, that's the one Gene did. "It opened my eyes to many aspects of this dastardly conflict, not least of which is the fact that it was not, in fact, a civil war. in the definition of that term. And matter of fact, Gene gave that definition that very night, even with my paltry memory. I remember that. He says, please keep up the programming that educates us about our forgotten or suppressed history. And that's what we're doing tonight. Thank you also for your continued Christian witness and your own testimony and that of your guest. Maybe I'm wrong, but it seems to me that a national salvation follows personal and family salvation. When a man realizes who he is, he begins to understand who he is. My combined prayers and good wishes go to you and your comrades at Blood River Radio. And that's Thomas. That comes from Arkansas. Thomas up in the western part of Arkansas, up in, near Fayetteville. We also, these people I just read letters and notes, cards from, they sent donations. We have Ken. My Lord, Ken, I feel almost guilty taking his money. He sends a little bit, golly, about every two or three weeks sometimes it seems like. Ken from New York. But he sent a nice donation too. And like I say, thank God for those people because that's what keeps us in the air. Well, people, let me see, what else we got? Let's see. Okay, like I said, our guest tonight is Gene Andrews. Thank God he's coming on. We always miss him when he's gone. In the second hour, we're going to be bringing on Jason Robb. Y'all people know him. He's been on several times before, but he's going to be on the second hour. And it'll be, during the second hour, it'll be pretty much Jason and Gene. They will be taking the show, and I'll just bring them in and out of the breaks. But I'm going to welcome my little brother. Well, I guess I don't know who's oldest. I guess we're both oldest dirt, I guess. But how you doing tonight, Gene?
Hey, that's no contest. I'm older than dirt. So you beat me on that about 30 years, I think. So
I'll tell you what, I was probably there to help make the dirt. I'm so doggone old, Gene, I'm telling you.
Hey, before we get started, I'm glad you got all those donations coming in. I need you to help pay for my cracked and broken teeth. I was listening to your intro there, and Mick in Rocky was talking about, you're going to eat nails, and you're going to spit lightning. And I tried eating nails, and I chipped and broke my teeth. So I'm expecting you to help pay for that now. Come on. All right?
Well, I'll tell you what. We'll sure do that. I'm sure our listeners are sending in plenty to donate to for that. I tried to do that, too, but I'm just not as tough as Mick or old Rocky. I guess they just Hey, that was just they ate that just for a warm up, man. They've been into steel cable, I guess. Old Rocky, that was a good old show. I remember seeing that show.
That was good. That Burgess Meredith did a great job as playing that trainer there. He stole the show. He's such a character.
He did. Yeah. Yes, he did. He was fabulous. And you know, I liked it because it showed. I thought it illustrated the guy's faith in his endurance, abominable
yes.
will. Yep. Never give up. Because you know what? I was always average smarts. Never had any talent. And I give it, you know, with what I'm doing now, it's just, well, the grace of God, I do what I'm doing now, training for these marathons. But it takes incredible amount of just, want to do it. You have to get up and run. Like today was hotter than hell. And I did like a 13.5-mile run and about a 12-mile bike ride. I've been combining the bike ride in with my running,
yeah.
But to kind of take some pressure off that hip. I'll just tell them.
Don't beat those knees all to pieces.
I had trouble with those too, but they're going great now. Now I got this left, I thought it was a trigger point, but the physiotherapist said I got some stuff going on in that left joint, but it's already, I've only been going about a week, it's already better. Matter of fact, I was crying the blues. I couldn't run a mile last week, and with that therapist, he's working me to death with all these exercises. Okay. But anyway, so much for all my daggum trials and tribulations. So, what are we going to talk about tonight, Mr. Professor? Because you just heard this letter. You've been educating us all, including me.
Well, that's something we had talked about earlier in the week. If it was okay with you and okay with our listeners, this is July, and we're winding up heading toward the last week in July. But July 13th. 1821, the birthday of a great Tennessean, one of the greatest military minds in American history. Nathan Bedford Forrest was born in the little frontier village of Chapel Hill, Tennessee, on July the 13th, 1821, and just passed his 200th birthday. And I thought if we could give our listeners something that I'd been working on for several years, and it's a program that I've given to quite a few of the Sons of Confederate Veterans camps. And surprisingly, most of the people stay awake when I give this program to them. So maybe our listeners would enjoy it. And the title of this talk that I've been giving is called Forest Strategy, If They Had Only Listened. And what would have happened had the Confederate military and the Confederate powers that be in the political office listened to the recommendations that Forrest was giving him. And there were so many times in all the books that I've read on Forrest where he gave his recommendations to the commander on the field. His recommendations were ignored, and we wound up losing the battle. And how many times he wrote to the authorities in the War Department and even directly to President Davis suggesting what they could do to stop these Yankee armies that were coming into Mississippi headed to Vicksburg or coming down through Chattanooga headed to Atlanta. And they ignored him, and we lost those vital strong points in the South and eventually lost the war. So if that's okay with you, I would just like to go through this, and then we'll take our breaks when we need to, and we'll cut it off when we hear the music and then pick it up after the break. Is that all right with you, Eddie?
Well, Gene, I tell you what, you do anything you want to. You're the I admire you as much or more than most of our guests. You have a huge following here, and I'm telling you what, I thank God you can educate. Yeah, you go ahead. Anything you want to do is fine with me, fella.
Okay.
Because I'm really looking forward. Yes, sir.
Started off, it's not too late at night, so maybe most of our listeners will be awake by the time we get to the end of it. All right.
Go ahead.
Okay. As Southerners despair to see more and more of our once beautiful Southland overrun by illegals from alien locations.
Oh, we got to go to our first week
of
break, Gene. We surely will, brother. I'm really looking forward to hearing Gene tonight because he always educates me, and he's so interesting. I'll be right back with Gene Andrews, and he's going to educate us, folks. Hang on.
This is Attorney Jason Robb, General Counsel of the Knights Party, based out of Harrison, Arkansas, and proud supporter of Blood River Radio. I, like you, am concerned about the destruction of our beloved America and our racial kindred people and our cherished liberties. As an individual and as a nation, liberty is what we seek. Liberty is important. It is what allows us to be independent, and if properly used, liberty allows us to fully worship God in all areas of life. And with that worship comes more liberty. We are on the verge of anarchy in this country, and personal liberty is looked upon as a crowning achievement of the people. However, Christianity and white law and order is viewed as the enemy of this newfound freedom, and that is why it is under attack. Learn more while listening to Blood River Radio every Saturday from 4 to 6 p.m.
During our war for Southern independence, the brilliant Confederate general Robert E. Lee foretold the decline of this country when he prophesied, if those people, referring to the dictatorial federal government, if those people win this war, the United States will become a bully abroad and a tyrant at home. As Lee predicted, it has come to pass. The principles laid out in our founding documents, our Declaration of Independence, and the individual rights protected in our Constitution have been vilified and discarded. But not everyone has surrendered. Blood River Radio brings you highly respected, intelligent guests not afraid to speak the truth when the truth in America today is censored and attacked. Your contributions keep us on the air in order to fight against the bullies abroad and the tyrants at home. Send your war contributions to Blood River Radio, P.O. Box 34636, Bartlett, Tennessee 38184. That address is on our website, www.bloodriverradio.com. Don't let the bullies and the tyrants win.
Excuse me, Captain. I know this may sound silly, but can you fly?
Nope. Never had a lesson.
Well, dear Blood River Radio listeners, you're still here with Blood River Radio, and we're going to go right back to Gene Andrews. Gene is the expert's expert on anything with the war, the United States government. They do what they do best. They invaded a sovereign nation, which is the Confederate States of America. And I'm going to shut up because Gene is the one that taught me that. So go back to you, Gene, my brother.
Okay. Well, we were talking about what would have happened had with the Southland being overrun with you know, from illegal aliens from Mexico, Central and South America. Now they're coming from Haiti and Ghana and all over the world. They're dragging them in here. So what would have happened to us had we won our war for Southern independence in 1861-65? Well, it didn't. And even Southern historians have bravely defended the efforts of our boys in grace by saying it's not so amazing that the South lost, but what is really amazing is the fact that they held out for four long, bloody, and brutal years. Now, various turning points are given for the downfall of the Confederacy. Elementary school social studies books cite the twin disasters of Gettysburg and the fall of Vicksburg. But you have to remember, the Trans-Mississippi Department on the other side of the Mississippi River continued with its own government, military structure, arsenals, supply depots, and victories after being cut off from the rest of the Confederacy, after, as his St. Abraham Lincoln said, the father of waters once again flows unimpeded to the sea. Well, in fact, these Western Confederates didn't surrender until a month or so after the Army of Northern Virginia and the Army of Tennessee in the East. Now, Gettysburg was looked upon by the Confederate soldiers at the time not as a defeat, but only as another drawn battle like Sharpsburg a year before. And don't forget, the U.S. Army was so badly mauled after 3 days of battering by Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia that Union General Meade gladly allowed the Confederates to slip back across the Potomac to the safety of Virginia with thousands of head of cattle, hogs, horses, mules, and wagon loads of grain and food supplies to see the Army through the summer and well into the fall. The U.S. Army declined to launch an offensive campaign against the, quote, defeated Confederates until May of the next year. That's almost 10 months. So, okay, how about the fall of Atlanta? And many other insightful historians say that the fall of Atlanta in September of 1864 ensured the great dictator's reelection in November. But remember, His Holiness, St. Abraham the Pious, would still be a lame duck president until the Democratic president-elect, George McClellan, was inaugurated in mid-March, not like January like we have today. The South was down to only one port open to blockade runners, and no doubt Lincoln would have continued the scorched-earth policy of genocide against Southern civilians right up to the minute he escorted the new president to the front steps of the Capitol building to be sworn in. So it was hopeless then. Well, not exactly. The South had one officer in the field with a very clear vision of the type of warfare needed to overcome the huge odds that the Southern soldier faced. It wasn't guerrilla or partisan warfare. But then it didn't require huge armies or mountains of supplies either. And his tactics were proven successful over and over again. I am convinced that the strategy and overall military concepts exhibited by Confederate General Nathan Bedford Forrest could have won our war for independence for our Southern nation without British intervention, without the huge bloodbath that the South didn't have the manpower to fight, and without the resulting economic destruction of the South. Forrest, as we said, was born July 13, 1821, in a small frontier town of Chapel Hill, Tennessee. He grew up dirt poor on the frontier, but through extremely hard work and determination, by the time the war clouds spread over the South, he was a very successful businessman in Memphis, Tennessee, worth well over about $1.5 million, or about $40 to $45 million in today's money. Forrest opposed secession, as did Robert E. Lee in Virginia. But when Tennessee seceded, Forrest, like Lee in Virginia, followed his state and threw his lot in with the Confederacy, enlisting as a private. There was no snobbery in Forrest's character, while others with that much financial status wanted a high military rank or a cushy political office. In 4 years of hard fighting, this middle-aged businessman, who never spent a day in a military school like West Point, VMI, the Citadel, or the Tennessee Military Institute, rewrote the book on mobile warfare, which is now studied in military schools all over the world. He never commanded more than about 8,000 to 9,000 men at one time. That was maximum, and that was right toward the end of the war. But usually far less, around 3,000 to 5,000 in most of his campaigns. But by the end of the war, he had more than 60,000 men serve under his leadership over those 4 years. Forrest proved his innate military ability in every command structure, from battalion all the way up through an entire cavalry corps in the Army of Tennessee. He also proved his contemporary and modern-day critics wrong when he showed how he could successfully command the combined combat arms of cavalry, infantry, and artillery. He said, "Never stand to receive the attack of the enemy. Always take the initiative and get there first with the most men." Probably one of the simplest and most practical military maxims ever but certainly one of the most often misquoted. He never said, get there firstest with the mostest. But then our forest and south-hating critics will probably never let us hear the lastest of that. Now, all that looks great in theory, but where did this unknown lieutenant colonel, who was promoted from private up to lieutenant colonel by Tennessee Governor Isom G. Harris, prove himself to have a clear vision of the course of action to be taken when the professional military experts didn't? It began early in the war and lasted till the bitter end. In a recently published book on Forrest, Bust Hell Wide Open, author Samuel Mitchum tells us, in the Western theater of the war, the professional West Point-trained generals hardly ever won, while Forrest, the untrained amateur, hardly ever lost. Started early, February of 1862, Fort Donelson. In the military for less than a year, Forrest was ready to show that he had a better concept of professional soldiering than the high-powered generals fumbling away the defense of Tennessee. Lieutenant Colonel Forrest and his small cavalry battalion delayed and harassed Grant's overland route from the fallen Fort Henry on the Tennessee River to Dover and Fort Donelson on the Cumberland River. Rather than being trapped in the fort, the Confederates decided to break out. On the morning of February 14th, Forrest led the surprise attack, capturing artillery and prisoners while bending Grant's lines back into a sharp V. Now, rather than just escaping, the Confederates had a second option. Besides retreating out or getting way down the road to Clarksville and Nashville, they could now throw everything into the attack and drive Grant back over the bluff and into the Cumberland River. And this was Forrest's choice, and this is what he told them he thought they ought to do. But the West Point and political generals came up with a third option: march back into the fort and surrender to a badly hammered U.S. Army. Forrest refused to surrender. He said, I didn't bring my men here to surrender. We're going out of here tonight, even if I have to bust hell wide open to do it. Hey, that'd be a great title for a book. And he did, with his command and about 300 infantry that scrambled up and rode out double behind his mounted troopers. The next day, about 15,000 surprise Confederates were surrendered to unconditional surrender Grant. So what could 15,000 soldiers have done to defend Nashville, or an additional 15,000 in the Confederate attack at Shiloh? Speaking of Shiloh, April 1862, again, Forrest's cavalry is on the Confederate flank, again capturing artillery, prisoners, and supplies. Forrest and his scouts creep along the riverbank behind the U.S. lines to Pittsburgh Landing and see General Buell's federal reinforcements being ferried across the river. He warns the Confederate high command, his warning is ignored, and the next day the outnumbered Confederates are driven from the field. July 1862, the Murfreesboro Raid. General U.S. Buell marches toward the vital east-west railroad junction at Chattanooga. Forrest swings around behind him, striking at Murfreesboro, Tennessee, where he captures U.S. prisoners, tore up track, burned trestles, cut telegraph lines, and released Southern civilians who were about to be executed that very morning. With his supply lines cut, Buell calls off his Chattanooga campaign and returns to Nashville. September of 1862, Bragg's Kentucky invasion. Forrest screens Bragg and the Army of Tennessee's flanking march around Buell so completely that the northern general doesn't even know that a major Confederate army has slipped past him and is now between him and Louisville. Forrest and John Breckinridge capture the federal garrison at Munfordville, while Kirby Smith and Patrick Claiborne rout and capture the federal army in eastern Kentucky at Richmond. But Bragg, who had the innate ability to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory, allows Buell to march past him to Louisville, then wins the battle at Perryville, Kentucky, but retreats back into Middle Tennessee. Forrest is furious at the wasted opportunity and the wasted loss of lives, lives that the outnumbered Southern armies can ill afford to throw away. His criticism stings Bragg, who relieves him of his command and sends him back to raise his second cavalry command in the war in just over 12 months. December 1862. Forrest's first raid into West Tennessee. Forrest takes his new command of untrained, poorly armed, and poorly equipped raw recruits across the U.S. patrolled Tennessee River into a heavily garrisoned West Tennessee, where he completely wrecks the Mobile and Ohio Railroad, which was Grant's main supply line for his overland Vicksburg campaign. Now, coupled with Earl Van Dorn's destruction of his supply base at Holly Springs, Grant calls off his approach to Vicksburg. And we'll pick it up when we get back.
Man, this is great stuff. I'm listening to every word, brother. Folks, hang on. We're going to go back to this history lesson in just a minute.
Daily Liberty Newswire. You're listening to Liberty News Radio. USA Radio News.
I'm Brad Bernard. President Joe Biden led the kind of campaign rally that was impossible last year, speaking before nearly 3,000 people in support of a fellow Democrat, Terry McAuliffe, whose race for Virginia governor could serve as a test of Biden's own strength and coattails.
You're not going to find anyone, I mean anyone, who knows how to get more done for Virginia than Terry. That's a fact.
Several states scaled back their reporting of COVID-19 statistics this month, depriving the public of real-time information on outbreaks, cases, hospitalizations, and deaths in their communities. The shift to weekly instead of daily reporting in Florida, Nebraska, Iowa, and South Dakota marked a notable shift during a pandemic in which coronavirus dashboards have become a staple for Americans. This is USA Radio News.
Rockstar Radio. Did you know this station, this network, is looking for their next rockstar broadcaster? That's right, we are. And it could be you. It could be you interviewing the guests, talking to the newsmakers right in the middle of everything. Have you ever dreamed of being a rockstar show host? Now could be your chance. Together with this station, we'll help you with everything you need. The studios, the equipment, your own producer, a co-host if you'd like, and so much more. Broadcasting is changing. There's never been a need for fresh voices and unique opinions like there is right now. You can do this. Our professional team will guide you every step of the way. Sound effects, show content, building your social network media, and everything you need to be the next rockstar broadcaster. Get all the details. Email Bill at rockstar.today. That's Bill at rockstar.today. To get started with your own show, email Bill at rockstar.today. That's Bill at rockstar.today. Don't wait. You could be the next voice for America. Email Bill at rockstar.today.
Belated and beleaguered, the virus delayed Tokyo Olympic Summer Games finally opened Friday night with cascading fireworks and made-for-TV choreography that unfolded in a near-empty stadium. A colorful but strangely subdued ceremony that set a striking tone to match the unique pandemic games. The focus is different for the athletes. Kendra Harrison, Team USA Track and Field.
When you're lined up with the best in the world, like, you're not worried about the stands. You're not worried about the people there. You're just worried about going out there and competing to the best of your ability.
Audio courtesy of CNN. An archbishop on Thursday responded to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's claim that she is a devout Catholic who supports abortion. No one can claim to be a devout Catholic and condone the killing of innocent life, let alone have the government pay for it, San Francisco Archbishop Salvatore Corleone said in a statement. This is USA Radio News.
Go ahead. Make my day.
Well, dear people, dear Blood River Radio family, Gene is making my day, and I'm sure he's making your day as well with this great, great history lesson, second to none. Go ahead, Professor. This is Professor Andrews. By the way, Gene's nickname is, I hope he didn't mind me naming, is the Bitter Ender. We'll explain what that...
I've had a Gene lot of don't nicknames give up. That you couldn't repeat on the air, so that's pretty good. I'll go with that one.
Well, I got them filed away just in case.
Oh, yeah, but yeah.
Gene, like I've always told about Gene, and kind of like me, Lee surrendered, but Gene didn't. But he is the bitter ender. Well, anyway, go ahead, Professor Gene.
Well, we were given, before the break, we were given a couple of examples of Forrest's really brilliant military strategy. He had a concept that seems like the Confederate government could never grasp until the war was over. And we gave an example of how he stopped Union General Don Carlos Buell's attempt to knock out the Confederate railroad junction at Chattanooga, and he never fought Buell head-to-head. He swung around behind him and took out the railroad behind him at Murfreesboro. And then the same thing happened in December with his West Tennessee raid. He knew that he didn't have the manpower to fight Grant head-to-head in northern Mississippi, so he took out across the Tennessee River, which was patrolled by Union gunboats. So this was quite a feat in getting his command across the river and undetected, and got into West Tennessee and totally destroyed the Mobile and Ohio Railroad, which was Grant's main supply line. And then Earl Van Dorn's cavalry burned Grant's supply base at Holly Springs, Mississippi. So Grant was stuck in northern Mississippi with no surprise. So he had to call off his overland approach to Vicksburg and turn around and retreat back to Memphis, where he had to wait for the U.S. Navy to build enough gunboats and ships to supply him down the Mississippi River. And Forrest and this West Tennessee campaign fought over a dozen small battles and skirmishes. He captured over 1,300 prisoners, armed himself with the best weapons the U.S. government could supply, and Forrest was very complimentary, as always, of the United States Army Quartermaster Department. He said they had excellent supplies, and it kept him with the best equipment in the field. And the point being made is that he affected the enemy's overall campaign strategy, and he never once fought a much larger force head-to-head. June of 1863, the Tullahoma Campaign. After winning the first day's battle at Murfreesboro, Bragg falls back to a line along the Duck River. And as Sam Watkins, the 1st Tennessee Infantry, said, "Bully for Bragg, he's held on retreating." And William Rosecrans replaced Buell as a U.S. Army commander, and Rosecrans literally maneuvered Bragg out of Tennessee and captured Chattanooga almost without firing a shot. Forrest was assigned to cover Bragg's retreat out of the state, and the Confederate Army will not return to Tennessee for 15 months, and then with disastrous results under John Bell Hood. Now, this, for our listeners and the whole point of our talk tonight, is probably the most important date and the most important item in the whole military campaign of Forrest that we're talking about. This is August of 1863, Forrest's strategic plan. Forrest sent a letter to Adjutant General Samuel Cooper, the highest-ranking officer in the Confederate military, and Cooper was actually higher ranked than Robert E. Lee. At this time, Robert E. Lee was just commanding the Army of Northern Virginia. So he sent this letter to Adjutant General Samuel Cooper, and Forrest outlined a plan to take his cavalry plus at least two batteries of either long-range Dahlgren guns or Parrott rifle cannons, raise troops in Mississippi, Tennessee, and Kentucky, while stopping supplies on the Tennessee and Mississippi rivers, strand Rosecrans in Tennessee, and Grant and Sherman, who were still hanging around Vicksburg, strand them in Mississippi. And this, you know, he did it with Buell's Chattanooga campaign and Grant's first attempt at Vicksburg. So it wasn't something, some wild scheme that he just thought up all one night. It actually worked before. So hearing nothing, Forrest then wrote directly to President Jefferson Davis, who forwarded the letter to Bragg for his opinion. Bragg, who hated Forrest for telling the truth, advised against it, and Davis rejected the plan, probably the worst decision in Davis's political career. September 1863, Chickamauga. Once again, in the thick of it from the start, Forrest's cavalry opens this bloody three-day battle at Reed's Bridge over Chickamauga Creek. The Confederates win a smashing victory, routing the U.S. Army from the field, but Bragg ignores Forrest's urging to finish off the demoralized and disorganized Federal running back to Chattanooga, another opportunity lost. Once again, if I can borrow a quote from Dr. Samuel Mitchum's book, he quotes German General Erwin Rommel, who said, "Never fight a battle when you gain nothing by winning it." Confederate losses at Chickamauga were 18,450 in killed, wounded, and missing. Forrest was furious again. Why does he, Bragg, why does he fight battles if he does nothing with the victory? The U.S. Army survived, would be reinforced, and in November would drive the Confederates away from Chattanooga and back down into Georgia. Bragg retaliates by taking Forrest's command away from him again and transferring him west to the Department of Mississippi, Alabama, and eastern Louisiana. 1864, northern Mississippi. Other than getting away from Bragg, which is Forrest considered a plus, Forrest assumes that he's being sent west to take out General Sherman's railroad supply lines before the Yankee general can begin his campaign to capture Atlanta. His experienced, combat-hardened troops have been taken away for a second time, and now he must recruit, mount, arm, and train a third command of the war. In just a little over a month, from November through December of 1863, Forrest raises his third cavalry command from nothing. Disorganized guerrilla bands, Confederate deserters, and a bunch of young boys. He's promoted to Major General on December 4th. Now, this is something that's almost so obvious we don't even need to say it, but the U.S. military had a better appreciation for Forrest than the Confederate government did. Grant was transferred east to take on Robert E. Lee, and now William Sherman took command of the Western U.S. Army. Sherman is terrified that Forrest would break into Middle Tennessee and take out the Nashville and Decatur Railroad and the Nashville and Chattanooga Railroad, leaving Sherman stranded in North Georgia. Now, Sherman had to depend on the railroads for supplies and reinforcements for a summer campaign against Joseph E. Johnston and the Confederate Army defending Atlanta. In the summertime, the Tennessee River was too low at Muscle Shoals, Alabama, to supply a large army if the railroads were destroyed. So in the spring and summer of 1864, four U.S. armies are sent out from Memphis to keep Forrest busy in Mississippi and away from the railroads in Tennessee. He defeated all four of those armies, or caused them to retreat back to Memphis, but the overall strategy worked. Forrest didn't take out the Nashville and Decatur Railroad until September of 1864. Too little, too late. February of 1864, Okolona, Mississippi. Forrest defeated General Suey Smith's cavalry, and Suey was his name, it wasn't a nickname, sent south to cover Sherman's campaign to destroy the Confederate arsenal at Selma, Alabama. With no cavalry to protect him from Forrest, Sherman turned around, retreated back to Vicksburg, then he got transferred to Chattanooga to command the U.S. Army there. April of 1864, his third West Tennessee raid. Forrest goes into West Tennessee to get horses for Abraham Buford's dismounted cavalry division. Not knowing where Forrest will strike next, U.S. troops are held in Memphis and all along the Mississippi River. At the request of civilians to do something about the U.S. war criminals attacking civilians in West Tennessee, Forrest took out Fort Pillow on April the 12th. Again, in April of 1864, Forrest sent a letter to President Davis proposing to hit Sherman's two railroad lines in Tennessee. Now, Forrest didn't have enough men to confront Sherman's army of over 100,000, but he knew how to stop a much larger force, cut off their supply of food, ammunition, medical supplies, and forage for their livestock. It had worked before against Buell, Grant, Rosecrans, and Sherman's armies. After the disaster at Chattanooga, Bragg had been kicked upstairs as a military advisor to the president. Davis again referred Forrest's letter to his senior military advisor, Braxton Bragg, who turned it down. Once again, the enemy's government sees Forrest's ability while his own people ignore the best possible plan of action. June of 1864, Bryce's Crossroads, the perfect battle. With only 3,800 men, Forrest routs the Federal Army of over 8,000, captures 20 of their 22 pieces of artillery and all 250 of their wagons, being used to steal food and household valuables from the northern Mississippi civilians. This battle is still studied in military schools all over the world today. July of 1864, Harrisburg, under the command of Stephen D. Lee, the Confederates suffer heavy losses in a poorly executed attack, but the Federal Army panics and retreats back to Memphis. August 1864, Forrest-Memphis raid, facing a much larger army this time. Forrest swings around behind them and launches a surprise raid right into downtown Memphis. General Smith's invading army has to turn back to Memphis to protect the armchair generals that are hiding out there. September of 1864, northern Alabama. Finally, Forrest is turned loose on Sherman's railroad lines, but it's too little and way too late. We'll pick it up after the break and tell you the closing months of the war.
Yes, sir. I'll have a few questions. I'll tell you, this is really exciting, Gene. I'm sure the audience will enjoy it, too. People, hold on. We'll give you this last segment, but don't worry. Gene's going to be on for the entire show. Be right back, folks.
I'm Pastor Everett Ramsey, pastor of Faith Baptist Church. A congregation of God's covenant people, informed Christians know that we are at the brink of a long-planned one-world government being executed that will not tolerate true Christian faith. There is a way to stop it. Our church has used God's spiritual weapons of warfare many times over the years, and in every case that was properly executed, the Church of Jesus Christ has been delivered. It is called the Court of Divine Justice. David used it many times. Read Psalm 37, Psalm 109. It includes truthful information, repentance, and imprecatory prayers. Blood River Radio is the only radio station I know that supports action based on truth about lies concerning the Confederacy, the Civil Rights Movement, the German people, the true Holocaust, and who the true covenant people of God are, and the sins and failures of the churches, if any of these this means anything to you, and it should, then please say so with your money, as well as prayers. You may obtain information from us about the Courts of Divine Justice by sending your offering and request to Blood River Radio, and we take none of the money.
I'm Monica Schaefer from Canada, a former political prisoner. Here at Blood River Radio, we are not afraid to tell the truth and shame the devil. Our mission is to fight against white genocide. We do that by exposing the lies. We talk about the American Civil War. We talk about the vilification of German people and by extension, all white people. And we even talk about that linchpin lie, the Holocaust. Deception by the alien enemy within has brought us whites to our knees. My last words at the Schaefer's speech crime trial in Germany were, quote, "If there was a law forbidding us to breathe, we would break that law immediately just to live. And so it is with this law. We must break this law in order to survive and thrive as a people," unquote. Please donate to Blood River Radio and help keep us on the air.
Being this is a .44 Magnum, the most powerful handgun in the world, and would blow your head clean off, you've got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do you, Bunk?
Well, Blood River Radio family, we are right back. And without further ado, we're going to go right back to Mr. Gene the Bitter Ender, Professor. Go ahead, Gene.
All right. We're going to finish up the last few months of the war, starting off in September of 1864, we were talking about Forrest finally being turned loose in northern Alabama and Tennessee, and he finally took out the Nashville and Decatur Railroad, but he couldn't get over to Chattanooga, or the Nashville and Chattanooga, and it was a little too little too late. And then the Confederate government turned Forrest to turn around and go west and come up the west side of the Tennessee River and take out the Federal Supply Depot at Johnsonville. Now, this is in November of 1864. And Johnsonville was built by the Yankee military governor of Tennessee, Andrew Johnson. He named the town after himself. And showing his ability with artillery, Forrest secretly placed his artillery on the high elevation on the west side, or left side, of the Tennessee River, firing down on Johnsonville on the east side of the river. And millions of dollars in U.S. supplies go up in smoke. Then all of a sudden they order Forrest to turn around and come down and join Hood on his Tennessee campaign. So Forrest has to come down the west side of the Tennessee River. And if you envision a map of Tennessee, the Tennessee River flows from east to west across northern Alabama and then turns right there at the corner of Alabama and flows north up through Tennessee and empties into the Ohio. So Forrest had to come down that west side of the Tennessee River through the corner of Mississippi, across northern Alabama, and they said it was raining. The roads were just rutted and were just really trying to struggle through rivers of mud, but finally caught up with the Army of Tennessee and crossed at Florence and pushed the Federal cavalry under James Wilson out of the way and gave the Federal cavalry a severe beating on almost a daily basis. John Schofield was sent out of Nashville by General Thomas, the Federal general there, to slow the Confederate advance. So Forrest nearly catches Schofield at Columbia and does have him trapped at Spring Hill, but has to fall back when his ammunition runs out. A confused Confederate General John Bell Hood allows the Federal Army to literally tiptoe past the Confederates on the night of April 29th at Spring Hill, another opportunity lost. The next day, November 30th, 1864, the battle at Franklin. Against the advice of all of his officers, Hood decides to attack the entrenched Federal Army at Franklin. Forrest offers to swing around behind the Yanks and go to up to Hollow Tree Gap. And Forrest had been the only officer that had operated over this area and knew the roads around there. He was there in 1863. He knew every road and every country lane from experience. Forrest told Hood, "This time we'll put the cork in the bottle." Hood ignores his officers, sends the Confederate Army into a slaughter at Franklin, and compounds his poor decision by splitting up Forrest's cavalry, thus rendering the Confederate mounted troops ineffective in the battle. December 1864, Nashville. Moving up the road to Nashville, Forrest places his artillery under Major D.C. Kelly on the Cumberland River west of Nashville. From December 2nd until the opening shots of the Battle of Nashville on December 15th, Kelly fights 19 different battles on the river, but no Yankee ship is able to reach Nashville. In another poor decision, Hood sends his best fighting officer on the field away to Murfreesboro to capture the U.S. supply base there. But, not knowing that Forrest isn't out there on those frozen hills south of Nashville, Union Commander George Thomas has to plead and then threaten his own cavalry commander, James Wilson, who delays for 2 weeks before he ventures out from behind the forts and earthworks surrounding Nashville. Thomas destroys Hood's army before Nashville, and the Confederates begin a miserable retreat in cold rain mixed with snow and nightly sub-freezing temperatures. Hearing of Hood's loss at Nashville, Forrest cuts across country and takes over the rear guard duties at Columbia, Tennessee. Under Forrest, the rear guard, like Napoleon's old guard at Waterloo, saves the barefoot, starving remnants of the once powerful Army of Tennessee. So in conclusion, how many times did Forrest tell the professional West Point generals how to win battles? They ignored him and lost. How many times did Forrest tell the Confederate government how to stop a much larger army and not only offer his advice, but he showed how to do it and changed the course of the war in the Western theater of the Confederacy? They ignored him, and today we must live in the enemy's country, listen to their rewritten version of history, and see our monuments and memorials torn down and our grave sites vandalized. After the war, President Davis admitted that he was misled by Bragg, among others, and saw Forrest only as a very successful raider in small operations. But Forrest saw the big picture, the overall full-dimensional concept of the war that the Confederate government could never see. Only his enemies recognized Forrest's threat to their overall planning and war plans. He was never recognized by his own people in positions of authority until it was too late. So, Eddie, I think that would pretty much cover our opinion of what Forrest could have done had he been given the opportunity to be turned loose on these federal armies. And the thing that impressed me about it, he never once fought Grant, Sherman, Buell, Rosecrans, any of them head-to-head. But he stopped all four of them at one time or another in the war by simply just swinging around behind them and taking out their supplies. And you have to understand, this was a two-dimensional war. There was no three-dimension. They couldn't fly supplies in or fly over and parachute supplies in or anything like in what we could do today. So once you took out the railroad or shut down the rivers, you had an army of anywhere from 60 to over 100,000 stuck with no supplies and no forage for their animals. And you think how many horses and mules it took to pull all the artillery, the wagons with food, ammunition, medical supplies. They had a huge army of just animals that had to be fed and cared for. So it was a logistic nightmare to supply these huge armies that were operating out in the field. And once you took their supply route away from them, they were stuck right there. And Forrest understood that, and that's how he fought his campaigns.
You know, Gene, he made it look, by seeing what he did, what General Forrest did, he makes it look simple. You know, for somebody like me listening to you speak and describe his tactics in the battle, he makes it look simple. It looks like those idiots would have listened to him much earlier. I mean, I think you said that they marched back into that fort. Was it Fort Donelson?
Up there on the Cumberland River at Dover. Yeah, they just turned around and marched back in. And Forrest was furious. He was saying, we can get them out of here. We can get everybody out. He said, oh, no, it's too cold. They'll have to cross the creek. They'll die. They didn't call it hyperthermia. They called it exposure. They'll die of exposure. And they will be caught out in the open. Said Forrest told him, I said, our cavalry will cover the retreat. They will not fire one shot at you or the infantry. I'll guarantee you they will. I will cover the retreat, and they will not touch us until we get out of here and get to Nashville. And they ignored it.
How pathetic. That's a disgrace. Somebody, you know what? Somebody should have been almost executed by fire squad for that.
Well, it should have been court-martialed, that's for darn sure. But you had the thing they couldn't see is that throughout the entire war, the Confederate government and the Confederate military pinned their hopes on winning one gigantic battle. That was the whole point of Lee crossing the Potomac and going into Maryland that September of 1862, which wound up with a battle at Sharpsburg. And then the next year, crossed again at Williamsport, going across the Potomac, trying to win a major battle on northern soil and threatening Washington and getting the war over. And they constantly pin their hopes on one of the on these conventional types of battles, which the South could never win. I mean, we could not win a war of attrition. The South might win the battle on a tactical battle on the field, but we would take 5,000 casualties, and we could only replace maybe 1,000 of those. The North would lose the battle and lose 10 or 15,000 casualties, and they could replace that 10 or 15,000 with 20 or 30 and be ready to go again and send another army out from Washington or bring in Irish or German mercenaries to fight for them. So, you know, the South could never win a war of attrition. It just wasn't going to happen. And once the battle at First Manassas was over and the Confederates routed Irwin McDowell and the Federal Army on the field at Manassas there in July of 1861 and then didn't pursue them into Washington, the Federal Army, after the defeat at Manassas, they trampled and stampeded over all the civilians that had come out from Washington to see this one and only battle that was going to be fought. I mean, they just ran over these people. There were carriages that were turned over and picnic baskets that were kicked out of the way, and they thought it was going to be a big show. And the Federal Army stampeded over all these civilians. And so, but the Confederates were, even President Davis came out on the field to see what was going on. There were all kinds of excuses. They were too exhausted. They were too disorganized. Well, heck, the Federal Army was disorganized. And that's where Forrest really had the upper hand. When an army was defeated, he didn't let go of them. He chomped down on them like a bulldog. And, yes, his men were tired. And, yes, they were running low on ammunition. And, yes, the horses were exhausted. But the other side was tired and exhausted, but they were defeated. And that's like, you know, playing a football game. You might be tired in the fourth quarter, but if you're winning 49 to nothing, you feel a whole lot better than the team on the other side that's getting beat 49 to nothing. And so being tired doesn't matter as much when you're winning as it does when you're losing. So, and Forrest understood that. You know, he knew that, you know, once you get an enemy defeated and on the run, then you pour everybody into the fight that you can. And a lot of times, he would take the horse holders that were holding the horses back at the rear and tell them, tie the horses to a tree, throw everybody on the line. Let's go. Everybody up front. You know, we've got the enemy defeated. We're going to run them all the way back to Memphis if we can. So,
better kill those sorry dogs. You know, there's so much thing that so many questions I like to ask in comments, but, you know, you mentioned Forrest came into Memphis. You know, back before we got is the controlled by communists like we are now here in Memphis, there used to be a marker in alley downtown between Main Street and Front Street down toward Riverside Drive, where legend has it, and General Forrest, in fact, you'll know this, I remember my dad telling me General Forrest, I think, rode his horse into the Gayoso Hotel.
Actually, it's his brother that did that, Jeffrey. Yeah, he did.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, tell us a little bit about that before we go to the break.
They were in there, and you know, they were trying to capture these Union generals, and one of them, and I can't remember his name. I'll have to look it up. He ran out of the hotel where he was staying and hid under the outhouse. Now, that was a pleasant place to hide. You know, in his nightshirt. The first thing he knew, he heard all these gunshots and things going on out there. He took off out the back door the hotel and jumped in the outdoor toilet to hide. So that was a very embarrassing situation. So
what a fitting place for those Yankees. Well, didn't he also, well, before we go to the break, I think he had that general's uniform, General Forrest.
Captain
had it
clean,
printed, sent it back to him.
Under a flag
what
of
a gentleman.
Like they were exchanging prisoners.
We need people like that today. Well, people, Gene, we're getting ready to go to the second hour. We're going to pick up Jason Robb when we come back. She should be on the line any second now. People, hold on. We're transitioning to the second hour. Be right back.